from the Carter Subaru Studios, this is the G and Ursula Show with G. Scott and Ursula Wojtyn.
Good morning, everybody. Happy Tuesday, and welcome to the G and Ursula Show. G is off today. Drays is my co-host this morning. Good morning, Drays.
Good morning, Ursula.
How's it going?
You know what? I'm feeling really, really good. It's Tuesday. It's sunny here, and so I'm ready to go.
Awesome. Well, it's still sunny here, and it is our last day of summer.
Is it not, Heather? I know, but we're going out with a bang, yes. Drays and Ursula. It's going to be possibly 76 degrees and sunny. It's that perfect crisp day.
Absolutely. So enjoy it for sure. We have a very packed show. We are going to get right to our top five stories of the day, brought to you by Economy Fence. The city of Seattle and the state are teaming up now, and they're going to be spending another $50 million to buy three brand new buildings to house the homeless.
We are in a housing crisis here in our city and across America, which can only be aided if government at all levels add their assistance.
Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan says these buildings are going to provide 165 apartments that are rent and income restricted, and they will be available for tenants this fall. Meanwhile, in Ballard, a homeless encampment at a park known as the Commons continues to be a magnet for crime. We get more on that from Cairo 7 TV's Dee Dee Sun.
There's just large billowing smoke.
A fire at the Ballard Commons Saturday burned up a tent and involved multiple propane tanks. Seattle Fire says no one got hurt, but this is the latest in a string of incidents at the Commons. A woman was shot in August. In July, a man living in a van was attacked. Neighborhood group the Ballard Alliance has been calling on the city to get the folks who live here help, and they want to see the camp cleared. Some in the neighborhood agree.
Do we need to wait until someone dies here? Like, is that what we're waiting for?
But today, people who are advocating for the unsheltered say if this camp gets cleared, that brings an even worse toll.
Because starting over, as we enter winter, when you are already chronically ill, already struggling, already don't have your basic needs met, to have those basic needs that you do have gone, in addition to the only community that you know and the only support system that you have is now gone, people will die.
Some people who are staying at the camp here say they will not move again.
I refuse to move this time. I'm sick of it. It's a waste of money.
You hear that constant pull and push, and it's hard to not get your blood boiling. But let's start, Drays, with the idea of another $50 million spent on apartments for the homeless.
You know what? I'm like, sheesh, where is all of this money coming from? I mean, I'm sorry. I grew up in a time where, you know, you were told there was no money for anything, right? I mean, remember trying to get Safeco Field built? It was $300 million and there was no money. Taxpayers don't want it. And all of a sudden, we're just shelling out money for so many different things. There's money. If you don't have a job, we got money. If you don't, you know, and I, you know, what's hard for me, though, is like it also feels like a Band-Aid and not like we're trying to actually resolve and fix problems. We're just trying to kind of put them somewhere. So we're throwing money at it, but not trying to resolve it. What do you think?
Well, you know, I was actually going over some of these figures with Hannah, who has been covering the story. And it's hard to keep track of the money that is being allotted for the homelessness crisis and all the different parts that go with it. Because in June of this year, the city council approved nearly $130 million in federal COVID relief funds for the homeless. I know that the mayor's 2021 budget included a record $167 million to address our homelessness crisis. That was to create these new shelter spaces, et cetera. Mm. And now with this additional, you know, these three new buildings, they're saying, well, we want to target the youth and get some of the young people into housing, which I think absolutely you're correct. I feel like, though, at this point, we need a dashboard. You know how we have this COVID dashboard? We need a dashboard like, here's where the money's going. This is how much we're allotting. Here's where the money's going. This is what our priority list is, and these are the results, because we never hear when the results happen, or somehow we just keep hearing about the money that's going out, but when are we going to see some of the progress that's being made? Because if you look around, you hear the frustration in Ballard. I feel horrible for the honestly, I feel horrible for the neighbors in Ballard. I used to live in Ballard, so I know exactly where this is. They had to not allow the spray park over the summer because it was not very safe. As you heard in Dee Dee's son's report, there have been all these things happening, and one of the residents correctly asked, are we waiting for someone to get killed? Because that's what it seems like it takes before something is actually done. Now, the city is saying in a couple of months, because we've just flat out run out of shelter space, we should see some of these things like Ballard get cleared. But again, it's not just about clearing, because we saw it was at Chef on City Hall Park. The feeling was that many of them just moved on to Pioneer Square.
Well, some of the people that were living at City Hall Park were that. Like, yeah, we just moved down Pioneer. You know, whatever.
Exactly. So it's like, it's great that you're finding the money and we've got allotted this money, but what is happening with that money? And what are the things that we can say, okay, here's where the progress is being made? I mean, that's what you do with every business.
Well, this is just, again, I started it by saying this and I'll say it again. It feels like we're putting a Band-Aid on an issue. We are not trying to resolve homelessness. We're trying to get them out of your neighborhood. And we're trying to keep them away from people and all these different things. If we don't get serious about resolving homelessness, it's coming to every community near you. And we can't keep throwing money at it. It's not a resolution. At some point, we've got to get people back on their feet, get them back into society, get them back producing. And that takes love, patience, care, caring about people, finding out what's going on, and trying to get them back on their feet. And that takes time. You can't just throw a dollar amount at it, put them in a building, and think you can walk off and this is going to be resolved. It feels like our medical industry, where we don't resolve anything. We don't cure diseases, but we'll keep you alive with the disease and you'll live a decent life, but we're not going to cure you of the disease.
Yeah, and you bring up a great point. So with the drug addictions and mental health issues, again, mm-hmm. So what's going into that? What are what are the plans for that? I mean, and mm-hmm. I think they need to at least communicate that to us so we know, hey, our money is going towards something versus, you know, keeping this homeless industrial complex going,
and
you don't want to get it to the point where everyone who had compassion no longer has compassion. I mean, you talk about compassion fatigue.
I don't want to be the guy beating the bad drum, but I mean, look at all this money you just wrote off. $130 million here, $50 million here, $80 million there. What could we have done with that money towards resolution, right? Towards actually keeping people from becoming homeless. There's so much that money could be used for, but we were told forever there was no money. And now that there's a huge problem, the money appears, right? And so to me, let's put the money into making sure people are getting on their feet and keeping others from becoming homeless, which is about, it's not just about love, but it's also about information and learning and studying what's going on.
True. On the COVID front, we do have some good news and unfortunately some bad news. COVID hospitalizations are slowly going down in Washington, but the number of people dying from the virus is going up.
There are 30 COVID deaths in the state in the last 24 hours. This is despite giving people the best care that we have for COVID, which is still honestly not very good. For people who think there is a cure and foolproof treatment for COVID, that does not exist.
Cassie Sauer with the State Hospital Association says about 1,500 COVID patients are hospitalized right now, about 260 people on ventilators statewide. And with hospitals still stretched thin, the governor has now asked the federal government for an additional 1,200 clinical and non-clinical staff to help with the current crisis. Your thoughts?
You know what? It's just sad. You know, I always want to give some hot take when it comes to COVID, and I'm just sad, right? I don't have a resolve. I don't have a way to fix it. I mean, if I did, I think I'd be making a lot more money if I did. But I mean, honestly, it just makes me sad, right? When you hear about the hospitalizations, when you hear about people on ventilators, these are human beings. I have a friend of mine who I work with whose mom just got out the hospital yesterday from being, and they were worried. She's had cancer, right? And so I don't know. It's just sad. It's sad to see our governor having to ask for more help for our hospitals. I don't know what we're supposed to do about it, but it just makes me sad. And I'm not the guy going, I don't think vaccines are just the cure and the answer to everything. And so it just makes me sad because I don't see a pathway forward. I don't know where the end of this tunnel is. And that makes me sad. What about you?
Well, so a couple of things. And G and I talk about this every day. And honestly, we try to find ways not to talk about it. But I think it's important to know for a couple of reasons. One is that the good news is we're not yet using crisis standards of care like they are in Idaho or in Oregon. In Oregon, they're having to postpone care for some cancer patients. And I just read a story about one guy who was on his way to the hospital in Portland for a bone marrow transplant when he got word that the hospital had to cancel it. Now, he has multiple myeloma, which is what killed my brother in less than a year. You do not have time to waste in getting treatment. So this could potentially be a death sentence for him because there's no room in the hospital. And in Oregon, and we're not at that situation here, we're having to take some patients from Idaho, but Oregon has 1.7 hospital beds per 1,000 population, which is the lowest in the country. So it's just being aware. So when you make the decisions right now as to how you are going to keep yourself safe, just know that is what the situation is in the hospitals. The other thing that's happening is that many hospitals here were ordering monoclonal antibody treatments directly from manufacturers because that does help patients with COVID from getting sicker. But now the manufacturers have become so inundated with orders, the federal government has had to go back to its previous distribution system, which is each state gets a certain allotment and distributes it to the communities. And then if you run out, you're out. Again, that's not ideal. Coming up in our three things at 10, you will be hearing from a woman who was vaccinated. She did get COVID. She did have to go to the hospital. She has a harrowing tale to tell. Thankfully, she's back home this morning, but we'll definitely learn some more from her and her experience in the hospital. A new twist this morning in the case of that 15-year-old girl who's accused of hitting and killing a jogger in Maple Valley. King County detectives now have evidence that she might be responsible for at least one additional hit and run near Des Moines or SeaTac. So detectives believe a man was hit by that same gray Toyota Camry a couple of days before 53-year-old Greg Moore was killed during his morning run. And detectives don't know where this other victim is. They want help identifying him. But the girl told police in the Moore case that she meant to hit him, but she didn't think she was going to kill him. So she has been charged with second-degree murder and felony hit and run. And prosecutors right now say they won't try her as an adult.
You know, I remember reading this story and just going, it was one of those kind of messes with your inner codes and all of your stances, right? I don't like children being tried as adults. And then you also believe kids just do really dumb stuff, right? And I know this might to some people go, no, this is beyond just dumb. No, it is a part of the thing where they don't quite think it through when they make a mistake. But this is different, right? Not only do you take a life and it happens once, but if this happened more than once, you know, I'm never going to be the guy to go try her as an adult, but it's okay, you're going to jump on the fence. And so you say, try her as an adult. That's your thought.
Yeah. I think in some cases, it is egregious enough that you look at it and you say, the penalties need to be more than someone who is going to stay in custody only until the age of 21. By the time she goes to trial and that is resolved, she could be 16 or 17, and then she's out in a couple of years. So,
you know what? Again, I think it might just be a code. It's hard for me to say. I don't disagree with you. I don't want you to hear that. I just disagree with you. I'm kind of like, it's a really hard one for me to say because I understand that some young people just have no clue what they're doing. I don't know who this person is. I don't know her background. I don't know her story. I don't know how she came to be. There clearly is some very serious other things wrong. That does not negate the fact that she made a decision. She is doing some things that are harming other people. But two things can be true. And the reality that she doesn't quite get what she's doing. It sounds like this was a game. The first story I read, it sounded like a game. She's with her friends. She's riding around. She's like, oh, I'm going to hit them. And then she hits the person. Not excusing her. She's wrong. Definitely needs to be punished. Again, those words are really hard for me to say when it comes to youth, to say,
and try them as an adult. And I understand that. I mean, I'm a mother. Yeah. And yeah. I understand that everyone has different circumstances, and it certainly is going to be looked at in this case. And that is one of the reasons why prosecutors decided that she wouldn't be tried as an adult, even though someone was killed. And the family yeah. of Greg Moore is devastated. Mm-hmm. And I get that. But now if there's evidence that she was doing it even prior yeah. to yeah. Doing this.
Yeah.
I mean, there's definitely... you know, even for her sake and for the sake of safety, maybe she needs to spend a little more time away yeah. from society and getting yeah. help, et cetera. But, yeah, I wouldn't be opposed to
so
at least
about,
considering.
So what if we were like, would you be comfortable with her doing 20 years?
Probably not. I don't think that would okay. ever happen.
Okay.
I don't now, think just, that's going to happen. Know, but she okay. wouldn't be the first. I mean, there are kids who have are spending life sentences because they've murdered yeah. several people.
Yeah.
Do I feel sorry about that? Not necessarily, but maybe could they show later down the line that they deserve, you know, to be released? Possibly.
Yeah.
But yeah. I also feel for the people who've lost loved ones and, yeah. you know, are only going to have, you know, someone spend a couple of years at most.
Yeah,
for that.
It's heartbreaking on all fronts.
Right? It absolutely is.
If this was my dad or my wife or someone who was run down by a kid, I would just be so angry and hurt. You know, like why? You know what I mean? At the same time, I'm like, I'm with you. It does sound like her getting out at 21 or a little after that. That can't happen. But 20 years or you know something like that, I don't mm-hmm. know that I don't know that I stand for that either. And so. How do you find that happy medium? I don't know. So.
I know. None of these things are very easy. Okay, still ahead. T-Mobile wants their employees back in the office next month, but it could be possible that many tech workers may never return. We're going to talk about that next. You are listening to the G and Ursula Show. It is now 9:34. Welcome back to the G and Ursula Show. G is off today. Dre's is filling in. Will workers ever return to the office once this is all over? According to a new survey of Seattle tech employees, most of them never expect to go back to the office. So what does that mean for the future of work? Our city, our region, and all the empty office buildings. Right now, we are joined again by our friend and former colleague, Mike Lewis, who writes about this for GeekWire. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Ursula.
Thank you for joining us again. Enjoyed having you so much last week that we wanted you back. So I want you to break down this survey. What stood out to you? So what were the main points of this survey?
I think the main point of the survey, so it was 467 tech workers that were surveyed. They actually sent the survey out to better than 1,000 tech workers. And what it appears to be happening here is that the stuff that you might expect, remote work, for example, that isn't a temporary situation. That is going to be much more of a permanent situation. If you look at companies like Zillow, they're going maybe fully remote or with minimal staff attending, going into the offices in downtown Seattle. Many other companies are switching to what's referred to as a 3-2, 3 days in, 2 days out, or the reverse, 2 days in, 3 days out. A lot of companies are doing that, and that is going to change downtown dramatically because downtown was 300,000 people would end up in extra, would end up in downtown on any given day, given all of the companies down there, and that's including South Lake Union. That's going to change. So all of those other businesses that work along with that, from the commercial real estate companies to the restaurants and bars to the apartments, the available apartments down there, all of that is going to be affected when fewer people go into downtown every day. And then it asks the bigger question, well, then what is our downtown for? And that is going to be one of those bigger questions that the Downtown Seattle Association and other organizations are going to be looking at this particular point, because downtown is going to change as we know it.
Hey, Mike, my former partner before you abandoned me. you know what? When you look at this, are a lot of the workers going to find themselves heading out to the suburbs? And if that happens and it changes downtown, as you're saying, what is the future of downtown? And then one other question I had is there a trend with a lot of workers who might be completely remote saying they might actually leave the city and go somewhere else while still working for the company?
Well, so the interesting thing about the survey is if you drilled into the numbers, people are definitely willing to, because of remote work, leave Seattle proper or leave downtown specifically. That can mean that they'll just head to the neighborhoods and work from Fremont or Ballard or the Central District, Beacon Hill, West Seattle, wherever, particularly West Seattle, since you actually can't access West Seattle anymore by any known means. So, So if you can, if they do that, then that's still, they're still going to be spending their money in Seattle, but they're going to be spending a lot of their volunteer money and their volunteer time and their personal money in their neighborhoods. Most of the people surveyed, right around 70%, were actually interested in staying in the Puget Sound area. They seem to still really love the area. So it's not going to be what the commercial real estate people have referred to as the three B's. I think that's Bellevue, Bozeman, and Boise, where people, where the places where people are moving. It's looking like that is going to be a small effect, but not a large one. So my guess is people are going to, this would indicate people are going to stay in the Puget Sound region, but not necessarily in downtown Seattle. And so your other questions are very, very good ones, and I don't think we have the answers to that. What is downtown going to look like? There's already some discussion that some of these giant office towers that have been filled with people, some of those may convert to apartments or condos, and in which case, if we ramp up the housing supply, ostensibly, we should start seeing maybe cheaper housing in Seattle, which would then inspire fewer people to move away, because one of the things that they mentioned in this survey, and it's very, very clear, that for all the discussion of crime and homelessness and whatnot, the number one reason people would consider or have already moved out of town has been housing affordability. And so to an extent that this may actually inadvertently help solve that, well, then that's, I guess, a little bit of silver lining here.
That is a little bit of silver lining. I'm scrambling right now trying to figure out what is the downtown Seattle vacancy rate as of right now, because it feels like many of those buildings are empty. But the latest I've seen was still back in April, where they said overall vacancy about 15%. Does that sound right?
Well, so vacancy rate is not unleased, right? I mean, in
true.
Other words, there's all businesses that are ready, that are on those fully leased buildings that are deserted are not, that doesn't count as a vacant building. That counts as a fully staffed building. So from a number standpoint, what we're seeing is the residual, the remaining, because business leases will tend to go 5 years in some cases. And so that those numbers are not being counted accurately to the extent of these are not people actually going into the buildings. These are leases that are still being operated by, say, a Zillow or by an F5 or one of those other big companies in downtown. We're going to start seeing, but we're watching them already subleasing. Amazon famously is subleasing an entire building.
That's true.
That it built. And this is when you're going to start seeing those numbers modifying, probably over the course of next year, but not this year.
So this was a limited study, but if this were to be true that many see themselves never returning to an office building, that actually makes me sad. And I'm not talking about just me. I've been harping about this forever because I do come in. I am a people person. But I felt so sad for my son, my youngest, who did an internship, and it was all remote this summer. And so he never really even got to experience that office culture. So next year he'll have to determine whether he wants to work there. But all he knows is working from his, you know, childhood bedroom.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree with you more, Ursula. I mean, you and I, through the entire pandemic,
yes,
I still went into Cairo when,
yes,
I was working there. And I actually like going into work. It's nice to have that flexibility on some days to be able to do stuff remotely,
yes,
although personally, I'm with you. And I think that also there's that collaborative element and that ambient learning that you do when you're at work. When you hear somebody else talk about something and you engage in that conversation, suddenly you know a little bit more about something, or maybe you change how you're doing something. From a newsroom standpoint, I do not know how I would have functioned solely working remotely. And I completely agree with you on that point. I think the workplace has its place, you know, in society.
Well, I can tell you how I would have done remotely. Horrible. There's no way you could have put me in 100% remote learning when I was young, starting out, and me be okay. And I'm with the both of you. I'm a relational person. I think there's something about human contact, relationships, laughing, taking a walk, going to lunch, all those things that are important.
Completely.
But And because we all have this nostalgic feel, how are the employers feeling about this? Is there a move for some of them to kind of, I know we've done stories around employers that are really trying to keep people coming to the office, but is there a movement really to say, no, we will never go 100%, you know, remote?
I think that they're figuring that out right now. And here's actually, you want to know what this wasn't in the survey, but I was talking to somebody else who was involved in the survey. And here's one of the really interesting things here that we'll probably start talking about a lot in the future. One, you're correct. And yes, they're trying to figure out, they're turning office space, cubicle space into collaborative space and trying to get people in for regular visits to the office. So they establish those kind of human relationships. But one of the really, really super interesting things here is they're also needing to figure out how do we manage workers and how do we manage performance measures? Because the thing is that some of that was managed by basing on, you know, maybe on flawed criteria, like sort of a Moneyball thing, like who you like, who comes in the office and is always smiling, who's bringing in the donuts, all of that kind of stuff. And now it's going to be much more numbers based because if you're managing people remotely, you don't get those other things that make you think someone's a good employee. Or conversely, if you maybe don't have that type of personality, might think you're a bad employee, even though your performance has been good. Yeah. This is going to really change how we measure who's a good employee and who's not if they're not actually in the workplace. It's going to be a whole new world in that regard.
Yeah, and one other thing, there's also going to be a lot of discussion about, are managers even needed? Because
there
I know that. I also want to point out, we're out of time, but I also want to point out T-Mobile is wanting their vaccinated employees to return to the office. So it's not all, you know, companies, but I know that even in our own station, in our own building, we're struggling with that question as well. It'll be very interesting, but I'd be sad if we get, maybe hybrid is the way to go. Mike Lewis, thank you so much. What's that?
I think that's the future, absolutely. And Ursula and Dre, thank you so much for having me on.
We appreciate you.
Thanks, Mike.
Mike Lewis writes for GeekWire. He also runs a bar. I don't know where that guy finds his time, but we always appreciate it when he comes on to the show. Okay, still ahead, we're going to talk about something new with the James Beard Awards and what they've added. And is this something that should even be part of an award? You're listening to the G and Ursula Show. It is now 9:50. You are listening to the G and Ursula Show. Coming up on Three Things at 10 o'clock, we're going to be talking to a woman who was vaccinated. She got COVID. She was hospitalized. She's back home. And she has a harrowing tale to share. And we will hear from her at 10:06. But right now, we want to talk about James Beard Awards.
Well, look, Ursula, at this moment in time in American history, we are seeing massive corporations, private companies, award shows, and even sport teams weigh in on social justice issues like race. But when does it go too far? So when we talk about the James Beard Awards, for those who don't know, it's like the Oscars of the food and wine world. Beginning next year, in order to win a James Beard Award, nominees must show their commitment to social justice. So my question to you, Ursula, does social justice have to be a part of everything? Or does this make sense for food, or is this going too far?
Okay. I think that social justice should be something that you want to do. It shouldn't be performative. It shouldn't be mandatory. It shouldn't be, I mean, to make it part of the James Beard Awards feels like it's going beyond what the initial award is about, which is, isn't it about food, honoring food writers, restaurant owners, cookbook authors, etc. But now it's saying, okay, you have to have a written video or audio statement about how all your work aligns with the award's mission and values of equity, sustainability, and community. I think those are all amazing and really important things that you should strive for. Mm-hmm. But I would worry that this is only going to be done then so that you can win an award. And I think it just should be part of your fabric, if that makes sense.
I don't know if the people down at the James Beard Award are listening, but Ursula just gave you guys the roadmap. Ladies and I'm serious. Like, Do we need to consult some of these companies? Or some of the stuff I'm seeing, it's like, who is making these decisions? It's like we're trying to legislate love into the heart. You can't do that, okay? You can't make people care. You can't mandate care. You can't force care. You can challenge. You can inspire. You can teach. You can give opportunity. But let me be clear. I know I'm going to sound like the guy who, I'm actually going to sound like my enemy, and I don't know how we ended up aligned, but doesn't matter. Our words might be the same, but our hearts are different. Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you, sometimes I just want to watch a basketball game. Sometimes I just want to watch a football game. Sometimes I do. You can call me what you want to, because I believe Black Lives Matter. I stand by the statement. I live it every day. I am a Black man who understands I will live my life fighting for something I may never get, which is equality. And I'm okay fighting for the next generation to have it. I also understand there's a way to get there. And at some point, it can become too much. I'm tired of watching television shows where there's an agenda. Stop trying to force me to care about things through your television show, right? I'm sorry.
You are, and you make good points. But I want to make another point too.
Yeah, please do.
Why is it that people need to be ashamed, though, of really embracing the idea of social justice? Why is that phrase now something that has been turned negative and is often mocked? I mean, I think that's on the other extreme. So I think we have extremes on both ends, and. Like you said, you can't legislate love in your heart. You can't force people. But maybe there are ways to show without making it. This is going to be part of your go ahead, Chef.
I might have an answer for you, because I think people can smell hypocrisy.
Yes.
And they can smell when things are being done for performative purposes. When you have, you know, the LGBTQ flag on your corporate Twitter account and your corporate policies discriminate, or when, like, people just smell when it's not being done for genuine reason.
People smell the hypocrisy. Absolutely. Exactly. You need to live it, not just tell us what to do. Okay, coming up, we're going to have three things at 10. You are listening to The G and Ursula Show.